Here are the highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. Visit freetalklive.com for the full episode.
When the drugs came, they hit all at once. It was the 80s, and by the time one in 10 people had slipped into the depths of heroin use, bankers, university students, carpenters, socialites, miners, Portugal was in a state of panic. Alvaro Pereira, pardon me, anybody from Portugal, was working as a family doctor in Alohoa, I don't know, in southern Portugal. People were injecting themselves in the street and public squares and gardens, he told me. At the time, not a day passed when there wasn't a robbery at a local business or a mugging. The crisis began in the south. The 80s were a prosperous time in Olhawa, I don't know, a fishing town, 31 miles west of the Spanish border.
How different is Portuguese from Spanish?
Yeah. They have the same basis, but yeah, there's a difference.
Okay. All right. Because yeah, you speak Spanish pretty well.
Right.
Yeah.
There's no tildes above A's in Spanish.
Gotcha.
So I don't know what I'm dealing with here.
Got it.
Anyway. Coastal waters filled fishermen's nets from the Gulf of Cadiz to Morocco. Tourism was growing and currency flowed through the southern Algarve region. But by the end of the decade, heroin began washing up on Alohos, I'm just going to go with that, shores. Overnight, Pereira's beloved slice of Algarve coast became one of the drug capitals of Europe. Portugal decriminalized everything from marijuana.
Personal amounts.
Yeah, personal amounts. Well, everything was decriminalized because but that doesn't mean that everything is legal.
Did they also decriminalize larger amounts as well?
Well,
in a lot of cases they will when they're doing a decriminalization package.
Heroin's, so if you decriminalize small amounts of heroin, you have decriminalized heroin. Does that make sense?
I see what you're saying.
So there
you go. Somebody's still got to deal it. You know,
understood.
So sometimes decrim comes with lowering felonies to misdemeanors as well. But in this case, we're talking about lowering whatever their equivalent of a misdemeanor or an arrestable, jailable offense down to basically a ticket. We actually looked into this recently on the show. I think it was a ticket that would allow the police, they would still confiscate the product. So, I mean, it wasn't like they were just going to cut you loose with the drugs, but you wouldn't go to jail.
Is
over
that in
it.
Portugal?
That was in Portugal. Okay. And
yeah,
then
they're
also
describing it right here.
Yeah.
So rather than being arrested, those caught with a personal supply might be given a warning, a small fine, or told to appear before a local commission, a doctor,
right,
a lawyer, and
drug
a social
court,
worker,
basically,
about treatment, harm reduction, and the support services that were available to them. The opioid crisis soon stabilized.
Not only that, it turned around because Portugal has far fewer addicts today than it ever has.
Right. Well, this was soon. Like, yeah, if you want results, right,
immediately,
soon,
you're saying immediately after they made the political change of decriminalization.
The opioid crisis soon stabilized, and the ensuing years saw dramatic drops in problematic drug use, HIV and hepatitis infection rates, overdose deaths, drug-related crime, and incarceration rates.
Isn't that what people want?
It is, but what they also want is for people to be punished.
Yeah.
You've done something that I disagree with. To prison with you. I find that people are so married to the notion of prison that they would that they'll cut off their nose to spite their face. They'll suffer whatever the consequences are in order to stick with their form of punishment.
Is that because they got punished when they were a kid and they believed that it was effective? Like, my parents made me go to my room and I was better after that. So therefore, prison would work.
I think that people realize that consequences to actions, the consequences have changed their behavior in the past, right?
That's what, like, I'm saying, yeah.
And it, you know, consequences will change behavior, but it doesn't always work. And it doesn't, just because you give consequences, artificial consequences, because I think everybody would agree that making drugs illegal is new artificial consequences.
Sure, there already were consequences to abusing drugs.
Right. And, doing that, you know, has a whole variety of effects that people just simply don't want to acknowledge. The drug war benefits very, very few people. Those people are the correctional officer union.
That's right.
The police officer union, the government bureaucracy, generally government, organized crime. Drug testing companies. All right. That's there. I'm
it's
running out
rural.
Of it.
Yeah. It's a small group.
I think that some people probably go to alcohol rather than using other drugs. So you'll find that the alcohol companies probably would be against legalization of other drugs because they're a drug too. That's about it. It doesn't help you and me because right here in black and white, studies show, and we've done this over and over again, this is a new study. This is a new article.
About an old policy that's now been in place for 15 plus years.
Right. We know. And successful. I knew what this was going to say when I saw the words of the title. Right. It didn't surprise me for one instant.
But there is somebody
out
there
listening. Lots and lots of people who are listening right now who believe that, oh my God, if we legalized heroin, for instance, I'm not talking about marijuana. Let's go all the way and talk about real drug legalization here. If you legalized heroin, that people are going to be robbing us in the street. We're all going to get knifed by heroin addicts.
That's what they want you
to
believe.
And the opposite is true. That when the when the government makes drugs illegal, it drives up the pricing. When the prices are high, you can no longer work at some menial job and right. make enough money to buy the drug to which you're addicted. This is the question to the listeners. Is there an instance that you can tell me about? And I'm not talking about one-off, you know, one person that you knew about or whatever. But I'm talking about, can you sort of point me to a particular vice that has been helped, where the situation's been helped by prohibition?
And no one can answer that question.
I think I could come up with one.
What?
Prior to prohibition of alcohol, people drank beer all the time mm-hmm. in the United States. Like they really drank. They would drink beer, some kind of watered down beer for breakfast and then beer all day.
Wow. Well, beer was probably safer than water.
That's the reason. Huh. But maybe not at the time, but those people's grandparents and great grandparents had grown up in a world where beer was safer than water. Wow. You had to treat water in some way.
Right, like in the Westerns, they're always drinking.
What's that?
In like Westerns, they're always drinking constantly. Yeah.
The reason that tobacco is such a popular target for taxation is precisely because people do not
they keep spending.
Yeah, people don't
There's
change their habits.
There's probably a very small portion. There's probably a very small, Mark, you're probably like, half a percent or something like that of very unusual people who will actually decide to quit a habit because of its cost going up.
Well, if you tax it enough, then people are going to find ways
They'll
around
go
the
underground.
Taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And that was for sort of an idiosyncratic interpretation of quitting because of taxes. Most people who are quitting because of taxes are quitting because they don't want to pay the taxes. They don't want the money. They don't want to lose the money, not because they don't want to support the war machine.
It doesn't look like that the drop in cigarette smoking is as much as I thought it had been. The percentage of U.S. adults who smoke cigarettes is 17.8% in 2013, a drop from 20.9% in 2005. So in a little less than 10 years, you see it going from about 21% to 18%. That's 3% drop. I would have expected a bit more than that, right? But then again, this isn't up to date.
But yeah, and I think if you push the numbers back to the 60s or the 70s, you'll see a much greater drop in the number of smokers. And there's no way of knowing really what it is that did it, but I think it's more likely that it's simply that people just started waking up to exactly what cigarettes could do to them.
Tell me about that the instance when the drug war really worked and what the long-term results are. When I hear people trumpet the drug war, they'll say, look what we did to crack cocaine, but I don't really think there was much success.
Wait, what we did to crack cocaine, you mean when they cracked down on cocaine and crack cocaine was invented?
Right. Crack cocaine is an invention of
the 1980s time when they cracked down. There was an attack focused by the police on going after cocaine.
There's no guarantee that if cocaine were legal that somebody wouldn't come up with a cheap
guarantee.
Way to make it smokable.
But it is interesting that liquor, the concentrated form of alcohol, became popular during Prohibition, and interesting that crack cocaine came about during a takedown of cocaine movers and shakers.
I would also point this out is that you know, heroin was nearly unheard of when I was in high school. Crack cocaine was certainly
heard
of.
That was the thing. Yeah.
So if you congratulations, you got the crackheads to become meth heads and heroin addicts. I mean, sure. I'm not sure that that is like we can really talk about a victory here.
I appreciate where Gail is coming from. I've got a nephew who's in the military. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, the occupying force called the police. And, you know, I they are kind of like an occupying force. You know, I just heard an audio of Kelly Thomas, who was a 37-year-old homeless man who suffered from schizophrenia after being beaten to death by police off, you know, for over 9 minutes. He was screaming, sorry, sorry to the cops, but they wouldn't stop. Mm. What really gets me is when he called for his father for help, yeah. You know, and, you know, it's, there are no good cops. And the reason why is, and I know, I understand this. I was a patriot. I used to wave the flag and I used to want to believe desperately that my country was better and we had something special. Well, it isn't like that. Mm-hmm. It's not this collectivist picture anymore. People are individuals. You know, I talked with every time I say there isn't you know, all cops are bad, and people say, well, no, they're not, you know, and they'll say, no, not true. And I'll say, yes, it's very true. And I'll give you a few reasons before I give you the
yeah,
real
I'd like
good
to hear
reason.
That.
Well, it's very true because, and what makes me say that is things like the drug war, the anti-protesting, you know, riot police. The deaths of people like Romain Brisbane and the gentleman who was just murdered in the hallway. The painful truth is that it's the order follower that always bears more moral culpability than the order giver, because the order follower is the one who actually performed the action.
Right. They could put a stop to it.
Such action.
Yeah. They could just,
yeah.
They could just stop. They could just refuse to follow the orders.
Right.
But then, of course, the argument would be that somebody else would do it.
In some cases, they'd be killed. I mean, if you try to, if you take this to its to the sort of argumentum ad, take it to the absurd end. You know, go to the Nazis as everyone does, and say, what would happen if the guy refused to gas the Jews in the gas chamber? Well, chances are he'd end up in the gas chamber relatively quickly.
Right. I remember asking Rick Van Winkler, who is the superintendent of the jail here in Cheshire County, which we like to call the Keene Spiritual Retreat. I remember asking him, you know, Rick, what would happen if you, because he's an anti-drug war superintendent. He works with law enforcement against
prohibition. I don't
buy
that, by the way.
Well, I buy it because I've seen him testify countless times in front of hearings at the State House, and he takes days off from work so he can go and do that. And so I said, well, you know, what would happen if you just refuse to put these people in prison, the ones that you're told to, the people who you have said don't belong there, who at one point he said he's had 40
and
or 50.
He keeps them there.
Yeah, it's
Rich
his
fault.
It's his job. So, you know, he says they would put him in a prison cell if he let everybody out. So, I mean, everybody's in this for their own self-interest. Johnny Ray, you'd kind of brought up the old agorist plot. Agorism being the idea of kind of doing things outside of the government's purview, whether it be, you know, starting your own business without asking for a license, or in this case, you were talking about the ultimate goal of the agorist, which is to essentially supplant by replacing through competition in a marketplace the existing government services.
So, I wasn't necessarily saying that.
No, I
was simply that could be one way to go about it. But I think what would be more likely?
Well, you said you wanted to get rid of the cops.
Yeah,
by out-competing them, didn't you?
No. The end result is that I want the current professionals in the police force to be working in the market.
The ones that really got in to actually help people. The ones that got in to actually stop bad guys, not the badge heavies who want to crack heads.
Right.
You know, those are the ones who you think would make it in the marketplace.
Yeah, but I think that that's something that could be done with the stroke of a pen more than than somebody creating a compete than out
Hold on,
Johnny
Ray, are you saying that the law needs to be changed? That somebody needs to the governor needs to stroke a pen to abolish the government police force in order to allow the market to work?
I'm just saying that could be one way to go about it. My big point is that I hate the cops, but I think there are wonderful men and women that are currently police officers.
That's but an interesting thing to say.
They could be bad. They could be good. They could be virtuous. They could be vicious. But when they put on that uniform, they turn into a parasite.
Mm. Yeah, I do agree with you. I want to see that reality where I think one of the benefits of having a competitive marketplace in protection is that you can actually choose for the first time how to allocate your resources to these organizations or not to them. Or,
I think there are a lot of scumbags who are currently with the police force, and they're getting some of the virtue from those wonderful men and women is rubbing off on them. Guys who wouldn't survive in the market. They right. have a place in the police now that I don't think they would have in the... In
correct.
The,
now they're yeah. protected. Now they circle the wagons around all of their blue brothers, no matter how offensive of an act they may have committed in most cases, unless they get caught raping a child or something like that, as one of them did here, a police chief in New Hampshire did.
The official policy of decriminalization made it far easier for a broad range of services, health, psychiatry, employment, housing, etc., that had been struggling to pool their resources and expertise to work together more effectively to serve their communities. The language begins.
They could work together above board. They could work together without, you know, having to hide that they were trying to assist drug using clients or whatever.
Right. You know, I mean, it was people have a pretty low opinion of addicts, but I'd say that now with the opioid crisis and people who were, you know, at one point on pain medication, now becoming addicted to fentanyl or whatever it is that they're addicted to, the people are seeing it more often, and it's not quite as stigmatized as it was, say, in the 80s with crack cocaine. Does that make sense?
I don't know. I don't much care for drug addicts myself, but I've known a few of them who I do care about, and it's hard. It's hard to watch somebody go through something like that. I don't think that punishing people with a jail cell is the right way to influence them, unless that's what they want. You know, if somebody says, I think I would be better off if you would just go ahead and throw me in a cage, then go and enjoy your cage if that's what you want. But don't force that style of punishment on everybody, because as you were pointing out before, it in a lot of cases can bring people into circumstances that they otherwise wouldn't have been in, like, you know, getting to meet more criminals. And anyway, go ahead.
No. I'm sorry, Mark. Your rights are inalienable. You can't voluntarily give them up. If I were to sell myself into permanent slavery, then I think that it would be within my rights to, and I did it for $100,
yeah,
and I was never able to even raise, and it was impossible for me to buy myself out, even if that were an option. But let's say that not even that, I think that I would be justified in walking away from the contract because of rights theory, freedom from imprisonment is inalienable.
Right, it's freedom from imprisonment against your own will, as long as you haven't done anything to harm another person. I don't think there's anything wrong with, with restricting the movement of somebody who's a psychopath who's going around and murdering people. But we're talking about signing away your own right to choose. And why somebody would do that, would you be arguing that you were not in your right mind when you signed that contract, that you did not realize what you were doing, maybe you were drugged up or something like that?
Whatever the reason, I just believe that it would be invalid because you would be signing away rights that are inalienable.
So let me ask you this. So slavery is the delivery of services, right?
Uh-huh.
For essentially no money, some kind of recompense in this circumstance, because you'd obviously be signing the contract for something. But we're calling it slavery just to make it as bad as possible.
I think what defines it is the fact that you're not the one who chooses the terms. Yeah, you don't choose.
But the argument here is
that
you
can't
did.
Get out.
Shouldn't you have the right to sell your rights? Or
this is the equivalent of the question given to Christians: can God create a rock so large that he cannot move it? If you have liberty, do you have liberty to give up your liberty?
I say you do.
And this is.
I think it's problematic. It can be very problematic.
It can be very, very problematic.
Because how do you prove that you are within your right mind at a time when you made such a momentous decision? I mean, this is one of the most crazy, important decisions you would make, would be to sign away your right to freedom.
I think this is one of those situations where you will find an arbitrator you know, deciding, the arbitrators deciding what, coming to some conclusion a la English common law, mm-hmm. as to what is acceptable for a period of time and what isn't. Can I, one thing is clear is I can accept money to do away with my volition and work at a job, right? So
right.
I can work at a job for a week and accept a paycheck at the end of the week, and nobody's arguing that.
Sure.
That's pay at the end, not pay in the beginning.
There is a concept, at least I have this concept, where you can't necessarily do everything, you know, like sell yourself into slavery that you think you have a right to do if it does actually violate the rights of me and everybody else in society. You know, if you're doing something, and I won't go into the specifics, but I'll just leave it as a concept. I believe that that concept is valid. As for the other things you're talking about, here's one, for instance. In Albuquerque last night, I was in Walmart, and I was coming out of the restroom, and an old guy that was in the restroom came out behind me, and he just started talking to me. He was a homeless guy, mm-hmm. and he had been a military veteran, and he had ended up in prison for quite a number of years, and now he's homeless for many of those combined reasons. And as people often do, for some reason they can perceive that I'll listen to, he just started talking to me, and I just listened to him for as long as he wanted it or needed it, which is like 15 minutes. And at the end, he thanked me for listening to him. One of the things that he told me, though, is that he said that he volunteered that he hadn't had a good night's sleep in 6 weeks. Why? Because virtually every night, well, I guess every night, if he hadn't had a good night's sleep in 6 weeks, he described to me how every night the cops woke him up in the middle of the night, you know, violently and moved him on.
A contract is an agreement, and you should keep your agreement unless you become of a moral reason why you should break your agreement. So if I could agree to do anything Ian says for a day, and he could give me $100 for that. Now, if he says make me a sandwich, I should make him a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
But if he says shoot Mark, I shouldn't do that because there's a strong moral reason why I shouldn't shoot Mark.
Agreed.
So I don't think that that is consistent with what our idea of slavery is. Because you asked if I can sign away my rights, but the point is I can't sign away my moral responsibility.
I've read libertarian novels where they sort of talk about the future and what things might be like. One of the ways they solve sort of the incarceration problem, as it were, is that they fine people, and then people can't pay the fines, so they contract with something akin to a pawn shop where you can trade your labor in the future for money right now. So, for instance, I rob your house, and the amount that I'm supposed to pay back is $10,000. I don't have $10,000 because I'm out robbing houses, and chances are good there's a meth addiction involved.
Yep.
And so I contract with this pawn shop or type organization to give me $10,000 to pay you for the judgment that has been passed down through the arbiter, and then that organization would give me, you know, maybe 6 months or a year worth of my labor in the future to pay off that $10,000, and that's kind of how penitentiaries would work in a libertarian future. Are you saying that that wouldn't exist?
I'm saying that this may be a sort of contract, but like any other, if a moral reason arises for you, that requires you to break the contract, then you will and should break it.
The chapter in this case for me is chapter 23, called The Mirage of Inflation. And he talks in this chapter about the different advocates for inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's like, The people who are calling for the government to inflate the money supply, for listeners that don't know, that's what inflation is, where it's not the increase in prices, that's a symptom of inflation. Inflation is the increase in the supply of money, meaning printing out more money into existence, in this case from the Federal Reserve, the government making those choices, not just in the U.S., but in any country around the world where they do this, and they do it in all of them. and the economic fallout and consequences that come from that. And there's different people who realize different levels of the fallout from inflation, and they have different excuses as to why they support inflation. Some of them coming straight from ignorance, some of them just straight up lying or deceiving themselves about the economic consequences of inflation.
And of course, some of them believe that it's basically just free money.
They really believe that.
Yeah, and that when you put it into the economy, it just does good things, because it's like, you know, Mark, wouldn't your life be better if you had $100,000 today that you didn't have yesterday?
I'd like that, yeah.
You just heard highlights from the latest episode of Free Talk Live. You can download full episodes, subscribe to our podcast, listen live, and more, all for free at freetalklive.com.